boy, it could happen here. That's the name of the podcast. And I'm Robert Evans, the guy hosting the podcast. Who else is with me? Is it Garrison?
Hello, good morning, afternoon, evening, whatever.
Garrison Davis?
Yep.
Not yet a Dr. Garrison Davis?
Not yet. Soon to be Dr. Garrison Davis.
We'll
but
see.
That's a story
we'll
for
see.
Another time.
I don't know if you're going to pass the exam that I know you're going to have to pass in order to get through this class, but...
Sure.
It's a little teaser for the future. Speaking of the future, this is a podcast about the ways in which the future is going to be real fucked up and ways in which maybe we could try to make it less fucked up. And today we have on a guest, Mr. Calvin Norman, who posted a thread on our subreddit with the very simple, very unsettling title, The Woods Are Bad. And Calvin, you want to introduce yourself, your credentials, and what you were trying to get across in that thread? Because I found it very affecting.
Yeah, thanks, Robert. So my name's, like you said, Calvin Norman. I work in forestry. I've worked in forestry for a while now. I used to be an industrial forester in the Great Lakes region, so like Wisconsin, Michigan. Then I worked in the Southeast. I did my master's down there, and now I'm in the Mid-Atlantic. So I've kind of been around the eastern United States. I haven't gotten out west yet, but I'm a certified forest or candidate certified forest. I got like a year left on that, so been around. I also do wildlife stuff. It's pretty fun.
And yeah, your thread, what I found interesting about it, I have a good friend who is in forestry or was in forestry at least and got their degree in that. And we were out hunting in the Cascades a little later last year. And there was this wonderful moment. We'd been following a game trail up like this steep hillside, and there was kind of a clearing where we were, a clear cut, but there's deep brush all around. And we get to the top of this thing, we look out and we just see, you know, these rolling mountains of the Cascades all covered in this lush, beautiful greenery, all these pine trees and everything. And my friend says to me, it's going to be totally different in 20 years. It's already a different forest than the one I grew up with. And that is kind of the Cliff's Notes of what you're getting into a lot of detail here. And I'm wondering if you could just kind of like, yeah, start on that. Explain kind of what's actually happening in our woods, or at least the woods that you're comfortable talking about here. It's a big continent.
Well, yeah, it is a big continent. And you have a pretty good international base. And I can't speak for the Europeans or the Canadians. There's a whole different ballgame over there. And tropical stuff is just wild.
Yeah.
Really cool, but wild stuff. Mm-hmm. So mainly talk about the U.S., mainly eastern United States. So if you look at the eastern United States, this is a forest that has never existed before in the history of the United States. Prior to like 1920, our forest was like, depending on the source you read, between 20 and 50% chestnut with other species mixed in there. And now we have a mainly oak dominated forest. We lost all of our chestnut due to chestnut blight. Out west, you've got a couple of other things going on, but fire suppression has just changed the forest there. Same here in the East Coast and in the Midwest. You know, you used to see a lot more fires going through. I mean, some of that was lightning strikes, but no doubt a lot of it was, you know, intentionally set by the First Nations and the people before, the people that we think of as the First Nations. And, you know, that has mainly disappeared except for the Southeast, where fire has never really stopped being in the ground, which is really cool. But even their species composition has changed dramatically. A lot of what we're seeing is, you know, changes in human management, but there's also a number of invasive species that have changed things, you know, like chestnut blight, emerald ash borer, Asian longhorn beetle is coming in. You know, those are just the pests, the understory, and, you know, plants is a whole different ballgame. It's all not great. It's all not great. I was talking with some colleagues at an agricultural show right before I posted that, and we were talking about how the woods were bad. And we very easily laid out a scenario where we lost most of our remaining dominant tree species. It was not at all hard to do. It took about 2 minutes. So not great. And then the West Coast, things aren't great either.
And when you're talking about losing these species and stuff like the chestnut blight, where is that coming from? How much of that is sort of as a result of, you know, climate change? Like we're having a lot of tree species have trouble here in the West because of how much hotter the summers are and how much drier things have gotten. So how much of what you're seeing where you are is because there's been changes to the climate, and how much of it is, you know, I guess kind of like globalism, like people bringing in pests and bringing in blights and stuff from other areas, and it spreads like wildfire?
Well, I think that we're just starting to see the beginning of climate change, like driving species, you know, up the mountain, off the mountain out west, and here, you know, out of certain regions, you know, as things are getting hotter and drier, or as, you know, climates are becoming more extreme. You know, here in the Mid-Atlantic, we had one of the wettest years on record. I think it was like 5 or 7, whereas in the Midwest, they had droughts. But before that, we had 2 years of drought. So, you know, it's more extreme. And that's just starting to take part. But the extinctions and near extinctions have been mainly due to non-native pests. And that's just most of it right there. Just because we haven't really seen the start of climate change.
Yeah, but yeah.
It's impacting diseases. So like out west with the mountain pine beetle, you're seeing more generations of mountain pine beetle come through. I was just doing a presentation for some folks in South Dakota, and something like a third of their total forest was impacted by mountain pine beetle.
Jeez. And what is that, like when you actually talk about this, these beetles coming in, that's the kind of thing that, even as we've gotten more comfortable talking about sort of the different kind of collapses spawned by climate change, I think that we tend to imagine more spectacular things, these giant sweeping fires that burn through huge chunks of states and these huge like environmental calamities. What is this, like what happens when one of these beetles hits a forest, one of these beetle species, obviously not like a singular beetle, like what is actually, like how quick is the effect and what kind of comes after that? Like I know there's sort of a shockwave, it's kind of like a bomb going off. I'm interested in kind of tracing the root of that explosion, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it depends species to species. Chestnut blight was really fast, and it just seems to have torn through the chestnut's native range. So chestnut went from Florida to Maine and out west, like Tennessee kind of area there. And it just, you know, in like something like 15 years, the entire species gone. Emerald ash borer has taken a little bit longer. It got here in the 80s, started kind of going off in the mid-2000s, and it's killed a couple of billion trees. So when that hits a small forest, you know, if it's a pretty, you know, beetle that kills pretty fast, like emerald ash borer, it gets into your trees. It starts with one or two, and then within 4 or 5 years, it's in most of them in a forest. And then with emerald ash borer, they're dead in 5. Hemlock woolly adelgid is pretty similar. It'll just show up one day in a stand, and then the hemlocks are dead within 5-7 years. And, you know, sometimes you know what's going on, you know, because emerald ash borer is very clear signs, and other times you don't know what's going on because the tree canopy is so tall, and all of a sudden trees are getting thinner and thinner, and then they're dead. Or you have pests like oak wilt, and that trees are dead, you know, in 2 months, and then it spreads out like a circle. You know, it kind of exactly when you see like a bacteria like growth medium with the bacteria spreading out, that's how oak wilt spreads. And it's just like trees are dead, you know, 2 months, and they spread out and out and out. It's scary sometimes.
Is there anything that can be, I mean, it sounds like with most of these cases, like with what's happened to kind of like the chestnuts, and it's too late for a lot of that. Is there anything that can actually be done to stop this? Like, I know we have all these structures in place to try to stop the spread of invasive species, but like once they're in there, it kind of seems like usually we're fucked.
Yeah. Yep. That would be okay. Fair. Yeah. Cool. Once you get past it, like, there's what's called the invasive species establishment curve. So it's an S curve. Mm-hmm. And once you get like right, like once it starts ticking up, it's like, oh, well, we're done here. Mm-hmm. So let's start thinking about the future. And as you lose more species, it's like, oh, what do we do here? Or if you're like, you know, in the case of ash, it's like, this ash is going in a swamp. I have nothing else that's going to grow here. So now I just have an open wetland. Like, I can't grow any native trees here. We're done. So the biggest thing is prevention. Like, don't bring invasive species in or non-native species in. I was talking to a lady a couple of weeks ago. And she has hemlock woolly adelgid on her property. And she brought in a biocontrol, or she assumed was a biocontrol from Japan. It's a beetle. And released
no.
Yeah, in this case, it was one that had been tested and failed because it doesn't make it through the winter. But, you know, stuff like that. It's like, just don't do that. You know, I appreciate the thought there, but don't. With some of these species, we have, you know, like hemlock woolly adelgid, we have pesticides that work really well and that you apply them only to the tree. And so it's like, all right. I treated this tree. This tree's good for 7 years. Some of them, like emerald ash borer, you're done. There's just nothing you can do. So, yeah, it's prevention. And then you can quarantine, but then, you know, then it's like, this county's done. So we're going to just try to make sure that only this county dies.
Oh, jeez. You mentioned a bit earlier, like thinking about the future. What does that actually look like when we hit a situation as we have with a lot of these species? We're like, all right, well, this shit's we ain't stopping this. What is What do people like you do next? Like, what is the next kind of step for the forests? Or is it just sort of a smoke 'em while you got 'em kind of thing?
Sometimes it's smoke 'em while you got 'em. So, like, beech bark disease is going through just roasting beech in the East Coast, and it's going to the Midwest. And so there it's kind of like, well, you know, if it's in there and your beech are dying, take them out. And if they're not, don't. It's 99% fatal, but there's 1% that can make it. So, you know, like, maybe we find that 1%. Emerald ash borer is 99% fatal, but I've seen, you know, in the past couple of years, I've seen two that made it. So, like, if we don't cut them all, maybe some will survive.
Yeah, theoretically, we could then, like, clone or breed or whatever the trees that live, and in a few generations have more of them.
Yeah.
If other shit doesn't happen.
Yeah, the Chestnut Project's been going on for the last 100 years, and it looks like it'll take another 40 more. That's a controversial opinion. Some people say it's faster than 40, but, you know,
tell me about
100
that.
Years. Oh, the Chestnut Foundation? Really, it's a really neat thing. So there were some chestnuts that were found resistant in some plant outside the range of chestnut blight. And so the ideas were they slowly started back breeding. So they crossed in Chinese chestnut, which is resistant to the blight, which is native to China and East Asia. And so they crossed them in with the remaining chestnut with the hopes of, you know, kind of eventually breeding out the Chinese, but just maintaining the American chestnut and just getting that gene in there. And so they started that back in like the 30s and 40s when they realized what was happening. Well, you know, today is 2022 and mm-hmm. we are still without, you know, American chestnut in the forest. There are some backbred versions that are more resistant, but they will still get infected. I've been to a couple of chestnut nurseries where they're doing experiments, and it's sad because they'll get up and then they'll die. They'll get up and they'll die. And it's like, oh, there's two. Look, there are two over there in the corner that made it. And those get, you know, onto the next one. But there is some work out of New York, SUNY in New York, where they altered a chestnut and they put in, they just changed the gene. So the, you know, version that the gene that makes chestnut blight resistant is in that, and that's getting approved by the EPA, FDA, and USDA. Hopefully that gets approved. If that gets approved, we get real further along, because the resistant trees are not the same as the American chestnut. The resistant trees are they're shorter and more shrubby, and they don't fulfill the overstory canopy role that chestnut used to play. That's best case scenario. Worst case scenario is you're like butternut, which was, you know, driven to functional extinction at the same time, and we're just nowhere on that. Purdue's working on some stuff, but it's nowhere. They're not in the woods.
Now, how much of, like, because I tend to roll my eyes pretty hard when we're talking in particular about climate change, and people are like, well, I think that science is going to save our asses from this one. We're going to develop some, like, miraculous carbon capture method, and, like, at the last minute, we'll be able to reverse everything, and it'll be fine. I tend to roll my eyes at that. But this, and maybe I'm not, obviously I don't understand this at nearly the level you do, is this kind of a thing where if there's hope for a lot of these species and a lot of these biomes, it's going to be in stuff like we figure out how to hack these trees to keep them alive? And like, is that really kind of where we are?
I know some very good tree geneticists and tree breeders, but I don't think that they have the capabilities of, you know, coming up with trees that are resistant to all of the various fungi and bugs that are out there. And even if they do, it's, you know, you have to get them out into the woods. You have to plant, we have like 740 million acres of forest. You got to get them out into the woods. You have to have the nurseries to get them out. There's, you know, even if you were able to create trees that were resistant to all of these pests, it would be impossible. So no, the only answer is don't do climate change. And to the carbon capture perspective, the only machine that's going to capture the amount of carbon we need are trees.
Yep.
I do forest carbon stuff, which is a whole different episode.
I'm extremely interested in that, because obviously, like, we've been supported by a couple of companies who, like, one of the things they do to try to be nice is they'll plant trees and stuff, which is not useless, but also a lot of people think that that's what rebuilding a forest is. And, like, no, forests are a huge part of the problem with why the West is so flammable, is we chop down all these trees and we grew back just the trees to chop them down again. And that turns out to not be resilient at all to anything, because trees do not live on their own ever.
Yeah, that's why it's a forest. It's not just trees. Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah. No, it's, yeah, planting. There's not the infrastructure to plant our way out of climate change. There's not the land. It's just impossible. And
so
even if there were the infrastructure and the land, we don't have the time. Because, you know, trees take time to grow. They work on a different time scale than humans do. Even your shortest lived tree is 60, 80 years.
Yeah, and it is one of those things where, I mean, we have, this is what we taught, we kind of started this new season, which is forever with, which is that, like, there's nothing we can do that will stop us from continuing to face worse and worse like consequences of climate change, because the carbon's already been emitted, right? You can't just pull it out. Warming is going, even if we were to like make very revolutionary changes tomorrow, there's still some degree to which it's going to get worse. But when it comes to like within your field, what like carbon capture using trees and stuff, can you talk to us about like what that actually looks like, as opposed to sort of the, we'll plant a tree for every dollar you spend kind of thing?
So yeah, I actually can. I do a lot of my work about carbon, yeah, forest carbon stuff. So yeah, basically the idea is to make sure you have the best way to get carbon sequestration of the forest is to have a healthy functioning forest. And that's, you know, kind of where these pests and climate change are interfering with that. And so, you know, to maintain a healthy functioning forest on the East Coast, you know, some of these you need to have fire, some of them not, some of them are too wet to burn. And then, you know, harvesting needs to take place in some of these. Some of these don't need to be harvested. Again, we're talking, you know, millions of acres of, you know, forest here. So we're going to be incredibly broad. And we got to keep invasives out. You need to keep forest pests to a minimum. And then make sure that you're managing the forest, you know, as best as it can be managed. And I say managed, this is not something new. Humans have been on the East Coast since, you know, it depends on the artifacts you want to look at and what archaeologist you want to trust, but like 25 to 20,000 years ago, and the last glaciers left the East Coast 18,000 years ago. So we had people here before the glaciers were gone. So these forests have never not had humans' hands on them and never not been touched and managed by humans. And, you know, we got to make sure we're doing the best we can. You know, some of that means that we're managing forests with what's best for the, you know, that means managing forests for what's best with the forest in mind, not with best, what's best for the end of the quarter, what's best for your, you know, bank account. That's hard to do because forests are getting more and more expensive to manage and to, you know, manage sustainably. Here in the East Coast, we got to do a lot of fencing. We got to keep deer out of forests because their populations are so high. It's just ridiculously high and they're never going to come back down. You know, we have to spray invasive species. We have to pull invasive species. You got to go through and you got to make sure, you know, you're preventing all this kinds of stuff. And so it could take, you know, you can, if you do a good shelter wood, you can like make $40,000 out of it, and then you could put all of that money back into growing your next generation of forests. So forestry is really going from a profit-making venture in a lot of cases to like you're barely making money, or you're like breaking even or losing money. It's no longer, you know, if you really want to do it great, you're not always making money, which is hard for people to get their head around.
Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of thing that in a reasonable world, huge amounts of money would be diverted to from other things, like, I don't know,
yeah,
F-35s. Yeah. I feel like you guys could do a lot with one F-35 worth of cash.
I feel like that would solve almost all of our problems, yeah. Because the problems that you see in forestry don't cost a lot to fix, but it costs a lot for a forest owner, be that, you know, an agency or a person. It costs, yeah, a lot.
Yeah, it's like all of the issues around climate change kind of all circle around like growth-based economics. And a lot of, the, like, nothing has a shared root cause, but they all have this similar aspect to them where, yeah, every part of them gets worse by the extreme focus on economic growth at all costs. And that suffers, that makes everything and everyone suffer. So, you know, it would be nice if, since we have a government, it would be nice if they, what do you know, give more funding towards stuff like this type of forest management, which I know they do some, but you know, a fraction of it compared to what they give to like the Pentagon or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, even big, you know, forestry is technically agriculture, but even like, you know, like corn and like row agriculture gets a lot more.
Yeah, corn has massive subsidies compared to everything else.
Yeah, like the NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, they do a lot with, you know, farm agriculture. And, you know, it's very difficult for forest owners to get that kind of money into forests. If we could get, you know, that money, it would be a game changer, but we're not there. There is some change being made in the administration, but, you know, that's like 2022, 2024 stuff. And that doesn't help today. It doesn't slow down pests today. You know, you can't unkill trees.
Yeah.
I guess, is there anything that you're optimistic about within your field right now? Like, if you, I think that would be handy, both in terms of like, is there any sort of, is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Because I'll admit, like, when I think about not having the forests, that's pretty much the most blackpilling thing I can imagine, like, for myself. Like, that's the thing that I have trouble coping with emotionally more than anything else. There's lots of horrible things about what's coming, but that's the one that, like, really scares me the most.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to lose forests as a thing. They're just going to become, you know, if without things being done, they're going to become less, they're going to be fewer of them, and they're going to become much less diverse and functioning.
Yeah.
You know, for a lot of these, you know, invasive species, be they plants, you know, especially invasive plants, we have a lot of, we know how to control them. I was just writing a thing about controlling wavy leaf basket grass. It's a new invasive species to my area. It's highly controllable, and we know how to do it. It's just, again, a question of people, you know, getting out there and money to do it. You know, if we have the people and the money, we could solve that problem. Oh, also, if we stop, you know, bringing that in, that'd be even better. We, you know, actually took, you know, IPM, or sorry, not IPM, but quarantine and pest management seriously. And, you know, people, like, stopped throwing, you know, their local, like, plant out into the park just because, like, I don't want to kill it. Like, let's let it be free. Don't do that. Goldfish, don't throw them in the lake. That's why you have huge goldfish coming out of Lake Florida. Don't just cut pets loose and stuff like that. And if we could get a lot of that under control, we'd be in a lot better place. I don't think the forests are disappearing in the future unmanaged. I think they just become fewer, less diverse, and less functioning. Yeah. And then you lose species based on them, like birds, you know, wildlife, all that kind of stuff.
And also, I mean, one of the things that also they have to become less accessible, both because there'll be less of the demand as things get more fragile. Like, how else do you keep some of these invasive species out but keeping people out, which is, I think, a bad move for a lot of reasons, but I don't know. I also don't know, like, is it possible to have a global society where there is not just trade, but the movement of people on a wide scale and not have this kind of shit crossing, right? Like, that's when I think about, as someone who's more or less an anarchist, when I think about the only things that a border should exist to do, it's keep stuff like that out. But I don't know how possible that is. Like, a lot of this stuff is... I mean, is this the kind of thing that's just spread by carelessness? Because it kind of seems like it can be spread, too, by people who think they're taking care.
Yeah, both is the answer. There's some very good research out there about the, you know, relativeness between global trade and, you know, invasive species. But that also, you look at, like, colonialism and colonial societies. There were these things called introductory societies. Oh, I'm getting the name wrong. But basically, they're clubs. It's like, all right, I would like clubs of people. Like, I would like to see this new place that I live in, like the old place. Like, the European starling was introduced in New York because, you know, one guy wanted to see all the birds of Shakespeare in America.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, I get an even better one for you. The moth, formerly known as gypsy moth, that's the only time I'm going to say that word, is now found in America because of this one guy. I'll put the name in the chat for you so you can say it, because I know how much you love saying French names.
Oh,
This guy's one of the most French names
ever.
Here comes a wave of comments about our anti-French racism.
Oh, no, you can't be racist. This guy deserves it.
It doesn't matter. We still get...
Okay, well, this
which
guy
nobody does about my Italian accent.
No, it is. It's just the French. It's just the French.
Once again, the Italians deserve it as well.
Yeah. no, please tell us about Etienne.
Yeah, so this guy, he's a French scientist who left France. He came to the U.S. for a little while. He hung out in Massachusetts. He was also an amateur entomologist.
Oh, boy.
And he was like, oh, you know what I think America needs? Is I think they need a silk industry. Now, they have a native silk moth that doesn't produce good silk and it doesn't breed fast. So he brought in the Lemaître. I got to do the scientific name because we changed the name on it. Because the common name is a slur. So we're not doing
that.
So Lemaître dispara. So he brought this moth in from Europe. And he started trying to breed these two moths, which are not related at all. It didn't work, obviously. And then he just kind of, you know, he went off to be an astronomer. And he just let these moths go in his backyard. And he didn't tell anyone they were there. And then all of a sudden these things escaped. And now they're killing trees, you know, across the eastern United States. And they're in Washington, Oregon, I think they're in BC a little bit too.
Great.
Yeah. So That's
such a good parable, like a parallel to the invasive species that is French people. That really does just tie up all aspects of that. Yeah, amazing.
It makes me think a lot, everything you're saying about kudzu, which is in the, I've heard some people say they're getting a handle on it. I don't know how to evaluate that at the moment, but when I was last living down there, it was just like devouring the entire Southeast.
Yeah, you can handle it again if you want to spray it. You could get what's called a chew groove, so a bunch of goats. You can get a handle on it, but again, that's money and effort. So it's just a question.
Although you do get delicious goat meat.
Oh my gosh. I tell you what, the people who do goat invasive management, they have it made. What they do is they rent goats out to people. They get paid for the goats.
Ugh.
And they also get their goats fed. So when they slaughter them, they didn't even pay. That, you know, that's a good business model. Right.
As someone with a couple of goats, that does sound like the dream. Oh, God.
They don't work on all the invasive species. There are folks.
No, they probably don't eat those beetles, huh?
No. They also don't like plants with thorns on them either.
No. So. And it's very few goats can handle an entire French person either. So really, we can't trust the goats to solve all these problems for us. It is nice that they're helping. I don't know. So I try to, are there things either in terms of like acts people can take or probably more realistically organizations people could support that you think are actually helping try to stop as much of the woods from going bad as fast or reverse the some of the stuff we've been talking about today? Like how can we try to have some room for people to do something if there is anything people can do other than check your fucking shoes for beetles when you come back from wherever. Burn all of your clothing anytime you leave the state. Okay?
That's a good start. That's a really good start. Not even the state. Sometimes it's the county.
Mm-hmm. You go one county. Stop. When you go on a road trip, you stop your car at the county line and you roll it off of a cliff. Fill it with Tannerite and just let it burn.
But don't push that into the woods. We've seen that, how that works.
Not into the woods. No. Bad. No, into the ocean where everything's fine.
Yeah.
That's what they say about the ocean. Going great.
I tell people I work between the farm field and the stream. I don't do stream or water stuff because there's chemistry in there, so I don't know what happens over there. Mm-hmm. That's fine. I assume everything is great there.
It does seem to be going fine.
I think the best thing that you could do as an individual is don't cut random stuff loose. Learn the plants of your area.
Yeah.
Learn what's around you and what should be there. And when you see something that shouldn't be there and you know it's an invasive, remove it where legally possible. Obviously, don't go into someone's arboretum and start pulling plants out.
No,
that'd be real bad.
Burn down small farms wherever you find them.
Yeah. Oh man, the egg people would not be happy about that. Mm-mm. But yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna say anything. So I think learn plants, trees is neat. And then if you if you're thinking about how can you help manage forests, lots of people either own forests or know people who own forests and, encourage them to get a forest management plan or a land management plan and get that. And then also, if you got a lawn, rip your lawn out, again, where possible, and use native plants. I do some, some lawn change stuff, and it's just frustrating, the amount of lawns out there. It's one of these reasons we're losing so many, birds, and we have fewer birds and bird species because, they can't eat grass.
Mm-hmm.
These things eat fruits and insects and seeds, which you don't get in grass. So, if you don't own a forest, that's fine.
And I'm a huge advocate of that. I try to be on the show. And people, again, we always get this thing where there are people who will critique when we talk about some of these small scale solutions. It's like, turning your lawn into a permaculture garden with local species isn't going to produce enough food to feed your family. It's like, no, it's not about that. If you could get a couple of thousand people to do it and they convince another couple and so on and so on and so on, then suddenly if you're increasing significantly the amount of carbon sequestered by that lawn and you're also making a better habitat for birds and whatnot, that scales. It is a thing that scales. If we got a significant number of people with lawns to replace them with something like we were talking about, fuck it, kill that grass that almost certainly isn't fucking native to your area, plant stuff that is and try to reintegrate at least your lawn back into the local ecology. If you got a million Americans to do a version of that, you that's not an insignificant thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is something that you can do.
In a lot of states, there's programs to support it. In my state, there's a program specifically for like changing lawns over. Mm-hmm. And that program is backed up. They are out of money until 2024. They spent it all already. Oh. There's definitely interest there.
Again, give them an F-35. Let them sell it to whoever. Anyone gets it if they want it.
It just goes up on Craigslist. All right.
Yeah, put it on Craigslist. Cash. Yeah, give it to the highest bidder.
Yeah. The other thing you could do is go outside, like support your local land management agency. Most of these, like Forest Service and Park Service, they depend on money spent by users. Mm-hmm. So go spend money at the forest. The other thing people can do...
Wash your fucking boots first, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely that. And don't bring shit in. Yeah. Don't bring your like weird thing in, like your weird plant, because you don't want to kill it.
Yeah, your entirely seed-based diet.
Yeah. If you hunt, great. That supports conservation. If you don't want to hunt, you can still buy duck stamps and these other things that support wildlife management. In the U.S., wildlife is funded by the users. So those people who buy guns and ammo, and who buy archery equipment, and who buy hunting licenses. So if you want to support wildlife, the best thing you can do is buy a hunting license, even if you don't hunt. Mm. It's kind of counterintuitive, but it's the core of the North American model of wildlife management.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And it is it's also one of those areas when we talk about ways in which theoretically there's room to build inroads between left and right in this country. Conservation and hunting should be one, right? And there are hunters on the right who are actually talking a pretty good, like reasonably about conservation. Like it is an area of shared interest. Everybody likes wild places, so to speak, quote unquote wild. We just talked about how none of them are actually wild. They've all existed with human beings for forever. But like, yeah,
we like the outdoors.
Yes, the outdoors.
Yeah. Well, and what people ask me, like, so I hunt. I have my crossbows right over there.
Mm-hmm. Sweet.
Crossbow. Get a crossbow. Yeah. Get here. Hold on one second.
Yeah. You don't have to get a gun.
I have been wanting to get crossbow pilled for a while now.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't mind getting crossbow pilled myself.
Yeah,
get a shoulder holster for a crossbow. There we go.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Oh, that's dope.
Get a crossbow. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, this is not a super expensive one, but it's pretty much a rifle.
Yeah, I mean, ballistically, at the ranges you use them, there's not any meaningful difference, really.
Yeah, and if you're a person who doesn't like guns and doesn't trust yourself around them, they're very safe. Mm-hmm. So yeah, get you one of those if you want. It's a fun time.
Crossbow.
I also like it a lot more than my guns because it doesn't recoil. But that's enough about that.
Well, that's great. Is there anything else you wanted to get into, Calvin, before we kind of roll out today?
You touched on forest carbon stuff. That's a whole I do a bunch of stuff on that. That's a whole other world.
I am interested in talking more about that, but perhaps we should dedicate an entire thing. I mean, we should definitely dedicate an entire thing to that. It's an incredibly important subject.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot to say about how different indigenous groups have been, like up in the Northwest in particular, we have a lot of kind of tribal efforts at stuff like, not just with the forest, but also with like the coastline and whatnot, and rebuilding certain populations along the coast.
In the Midwest, Menominee does a great job with forest management. I'm actually doing a webinar thing about one of our forest pests, and we're having them come talk about their management. Well, we invited them. I'm not actually sure if they're going to do it yet. But the practice we use is based on what they use out there. So, yeah, it's really cool what various First Nations do. Super great.
Yeah.
I just want to plug trees.
Yeah.
Trees are neat. Learn your
trees. They're fucking dope. My favorite type of tree, probably the redwood. Used to live in Arcata, go running in them every day. I know that's kind of a cliche answer. What's your favorite tree?
This is one behind me here. No one can see my background. It's white oak. You can't make bourbon without white oak. So,
white oak is an important tree.
Forest products are like one of the only things that supports forest management. So, and it supports forests. So, don't be afraid to use, sustainably managed wood and wood products.
Mm-hmm. Find a good bourbon company.
It's capitalism.
And drink a shitload of bourbon. Always a good call, really. All right. Well, Calvin Norman, any last pluggable to plug?
Plants. If you want to learn plants, that's great. You want to learn about what's going on in your native, your areas around you. There's lots of groups that do that. Your local extension service helps you out with all that. Most of their stuff's free. So plug that. Yeah, go outside and plug that. I don't do Twitter.
Good. Yeah. All right. Well, go outside, hug a tree. Calvin Norman, thank you again so much for coming on. If you want to see Calvin's original thread, just type in "the woods are bad" and "it could happen here" Reddit, or just go to the "it could happen here" Reddit and scroll down a bit. You'll find it. That's going to do it for us today. Until tomorrow, go out into the woods. Go out into the woods. But wash your fucking boots first.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.